This is episode number 3 with nanophysics PhD turned data scientist, Wilson Pock. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. Super pumped to have you here on board today. This podcast is all about interviewing the top data scientists in the world to help you build your successful career in data science. And today our guest is Wilson Pock. Wilson is a friend of mine who I met back at Deloitte when I just started. We only worked for a few weeks together, but Wilson's such an approachable guy, you know, those people that are so open, so outgoing, and at the same time, very, very modest, that we got along very well and stayed in touch. And now he's in Sydney. He's working at a consulting firm called Ambiata. And before that, he worked at a large bank. So he's got some varied experience, both in consulting and in the industry. But what's fascinating is Wilson actually has a PhD in nanophysics. And he went through all of that research, through all of that education and academia, and in the end, he still decided to move to data science. And as you'll see in the podcast, we actually discussed that it's not an uncommon thing for people to move from science and specifically physics, but as you saw from one of our previous podcasts, podcast number one, where Ruben Kogel moved from being a chemical engineer into data science, it's not uncommon for people to move from science into data science. So from physics and chemistry and other sciences into data science. And we'll learn why in this episode, or at least you'll get our opinions on that matter. So that's one of the interesting things that we discuss in this episode. Also, you will learn how Wilson now, given his background, approaches business problems. It's quite different to your standard approach to business problems that they teach you back at university. It's more of a statistical-based approach, and specifically we're going to talk about Bayesian inference and randomized controlled trials. So quite an interesting approach where you don't think of a business problem as a single outcome, like having a single outcome, but you rather think of it as having a range of outcomes, and that's what Bayesian inference is all about, so we'll have a chat about that. And then you'll learn a bit more about what Wilson does on a daily basis, and that's isolating effects of marketing campaigns. So if you're doing data science for marketing or within a company to assist with marketing, then you will definitely find a lot of this information useful to help you better deliver valuable insights. And also we're going to mention how to drive change into business, because it's always challenging once you find something using data, how to communicate that, but moreover, how to actually drive business change to help people re-educate themselves and focus on other things when you find that certain parts of their jobs are not actually bringing any value to the business. So it's always a challenging question. It's like a psychological question, and it's got a lot of emotions involved in it. And so Wilson will give you his take on that. And now that he's working consulting, he does that on a daily basis. So definitely we can learn a lot from there. And for the techies out there, for those of you who want to get into the nitty-gritty of the data science, Wilson's going to go into a lot of detail on the R modeling libraries that he uses in his day-to-day job. He's got it all down pat. You'll see he'll name a couple, and some of them even I haven't heard of before, so it'll be very interesting to see what libraries he uses and how he goes about his modeling in R. And also, if you're a Python fan, you will see that Wilson works with Python as well, and he'll name a very surprising Python IDE without giving it away. It's something that we discuss in our courses, and it's not your first guest that you would go to for a large consulting firm. So definitely lots of valuable insights in this podcast. Can't wait for you to hear our conversation, and let's jump straight into it. I introduce to you Dr. Wilson Pock. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this podcast. And today with us, we've got Wilson Pock. Wilson, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kirill.
Wilson is a great friend of mine. We used to work together. Actually, we only worked together for just a few days or a few weeks back when I was a graduate at Deloitte. And then Wilson moved down to Sydney. So I'm super excited to catch up. Wilson, tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do currently?
Yeah, so I'm a data scientist at a company called Ambiata. It's basically a data science company. What we do is we take a lot of the data that companies have and we ingest it into our platform and mainly do marketing interventions. We do a lot of experimental design to try to find out what works and what doesn't. But if I had to sum it up, I'd basically say that we apply the scientific method to business problems.
Okay, very, very interesting. So it's like a consulting type of firm.
Yeah. It's consulting.
Okay, so you've had quite a bit of career. Last I remember, we were at Deloitte together. Then you moved on to Westpac, which is one of the big four banks in Australia. Are you still with them?
No. So after I left Deloitte, I went to Westpac for a bit, built some predictive models there, some what I thought was basic stuff. But I think Westpac at that stage was still struggling a little bit with their data issues. Mm-hmm. Since then, I've moved on to Ambiata, where the focus is purely on the data. And so I've been able to use the tools that I want to use and work on more interesting problems, I'd say.
Awesome. So we'll definitely get back to your challenges and wins at Ambiata and Westpac in a second. What I would like to ask, because you're the first person on this podcast that actually holds a PhD and has done extensive research, can you tell us a bit more about your background? What did you study and how did you get to this level of academic achievement?
Yeah, so my PhD was in a slightly different field. It was in physics. I studied nanoscale silicon devices. But to be honest, I think since I've left academia, so the story is I didn't see an academic career for myself. I wanted to try other things. So I went into to industrial roles. But to be honest, since I've been in business, I've actually run into a bunch of other physics PhDs as well. So it seems like it's a common path that a lot of PhDs in quantitative fields, they do seem to pop up in the data science world, and I've been running into them. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's definitely agree with that. And myself, even though I don't have a PhD, I did do bachelor's of physics.
Mine was
also nanotechnology and laser physics. And so, yeah, it is kind of like I see people, like-minded people popping up in the field of data science. Why would you say that is? Like, what was your reason behind leaving academia? Why did you decide to move into something different?
With academia, it's very much about depth. You go into a very, very deep field, deep knowledge into a very narrow field. And I wanted to try other things. I wanted to try my hands at other problems. And so I felt that consulting type projects would be more interesting. But the other point is that I actually think that there is kind of space for people with quantitative backgrounds to go into business, because to be honest, the traditional people with business degrees, they're not so strong in quantitative fields. So there's kind of room for people with science degrees or engineering degrees to go into business. It just requires you to think about things in a different way. But yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I kind of agree with that sentiment that in academia or physics even, you have to become very narrow in your focus, and you kind of at some point realize that if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be doing the same thing for the rest of my life. And it has to be the perfect, you know what I mean? It has to be the perfect match for you to agree to such a sacrifice. Yeah. And oftentimes it's not. So it's always a great thing that you can always move into business and consulting with all these skills. They're very transferable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And so just on that then, what do you feel is a skill or, I don't know, maybe some knowledge that you developed during your PhD? So because that is a long time. You were doing it for several years, five or six years.
5 years, yeah. I think I have a bit of a new perspective now. So when I was trying to, make the move from academia to industry, I did have to spend a lot of time trying to argue the case for these transferable skills. But now that I've been in industry for several years now, I would look back and I would say that the thing that stands out the most as being the most transferable, most useful was basically being very clear with definitions and being able to define a problem and define the parameters of a problem super clearly. Mm. I think that in traditional conventional businesses, the environments, that doesn't happen enough. There's a lot of buzzwords, a lot of airy-fairy concepts, but when you come from a quantitative background, you do have to nail definitions down really, really clearly. And I think that has helped me in a lot of the projects that I've been on.
That is very interesting, because not often is that problem is brought up. That usually people talk about doing the analysis as a very you know, big deal, and then presenting the insights, the final part, is as also a big deal. But what you're outlining here is the preliminary phases, when you're finding out how to describe the problem.
Yeah, that's right. So don't get me wrong, like all the analysis, programming, working with data, that's all important. And I assume that anyone with any science degree already has that. It's what I didn't realize was that being able to define things so clearly, I didn't know that was so useful in business, and it really is. The other thing I would talk about is something that happens in, or at least in science and not so much in business, is that in science, we talk about uncertainty a lot. We have error bars around predictions. We don't describe things by a single number. So often we describe things by a distribution. And that kind of thinking comes naturally to someone in a science field, right? So a lot of things are uncertain, but you can quantify your level of uncertainty. In business, that doesn't happen at all. So in business, it's traditionally that you report on, you know, a single number for like the profit of a single quarter. It's a single number. The conversion rate of a marketing campaign, it's usually a single number. It's not really reported as a distribution or the range of uncertainty. That doesn't really happen so much. I find that's one of the things that is important to challenge. This is one of those things where, you know, a science-based way of thinking comes in, and it's completely different to the traditional business way of thinking, which is, you know, it's all about, okay, hard numbers, very, very certain. Whereas if you come from a science background, you know that there is a level of noise and uncertainty that's always present, whether you acknowledge it or not. I think that's the other aspect that I didn't think would be important, but it turns out that is an important thing from my background.
That's fantastic. That's a very solid observation that indeed in business it's different. So just then thinking about our listeners, because most of them will probably not come from a science background as you, how would you recommend developing that kind of mentality, that kind of thinking about business problems in terms of not just hard numbers, but what you described, the distribution approach and the error range?
One of the ways to get into this, and it's also been a learning experience for me, is look into, your listeners have probably heard of Nate Silver. He has a book called The Signal and the Noise. So it's a good introduction to this, to the concept of what's called Bayesian inference. And so when you look into Bayesian probabilities and like Bayesian ways of doing statistics, it starts to introduce you to this idea that you never have the final answer. You have approximations to the final answer or to the truth, but you can never be like completely certain. You have to condition your statements on, you know, okay, you know, you have a 95% credibility interval, things like that. So I would actually suggest looking into reading up on Bayesian analysis as a way to understand uncertainty.
Okay, that's a very good recommendation. I think one of our other guests on the podcast has already recommended that book as well. The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver. Nate Silver has a website as well, right? A very, very interesting one.
The blog is really good. There's actually other like websites that have like really cool visualizations that are good at explaining concepts. I think it's called Cetosa.io. So that's...
Cetosa, like Virginica Cetosa and stuff like that. Like the, what are they called? The iris dataset for the fish's iris dataset. That's where that name comes from. I haven't seen Cetosa.io, but definitely we'll put the links for that we discuss in the show notes, so everybody can get to them later. Okay, so that's some great advice. And now moving on to your current work, can you tell us a bit more? So you've told us about Ambiata and the type of consulting you do there. Can you tell us a bit more about some more specific recent projects that you've been working on, if you can disclose that information, of course?
Yeah, so like the main types of project that we try to run are essentially randomized control trials. So what we try to do is identify causal effects, which is not something that's typically common in business. Typically, you know, they'll run a marketing campaign and, you know, the conversion rate go up or down. It depends on a lot of things. It might have been the intervention, it might not have been. What we try to do is try to be very clear on isolating the effects of certain things. And what we found is that the gold standard of establishing causal effects is to run randomized control trials. Like the kinds of successes that we've had would be things along the lines of like running experiments, demonstrating that, you know, a certain marketing campaign has no effect or only has an effect that's within the level of noise. And as a result, we can say that you can safely, you know, turn off that marketing activity and not have any difference in your sales. The other things that we would typically do is we'll do uplift modeling. So if we send out an intervention, which could be like a direct mail or email or whatever marketing intervention, we would identify the people who are most affected by that intervention. So not the people who are going to buy the product anyway, but the people who are directly affected by the intervention.
Mm.
So that kind of uplift modeling is also the type of projects that we focus more on.
Oh, that's very interesting. So basically the first type that you described allows companies to significantly cut costs. So if there's an activity that they're performing, they don't need to perform, they just cut it off. So basically your analysis will pay for itself. And on the other hand, if they don't need to cut the cost, they'll know the quantitative effect of that marketing activity, right? So they can invest more into it.
That's right. So we found that a lot of marketing activity has been there. Like there's a lot of opinions, a lot of knowledge that's accumulated, but it's not clear what that knowledge is based on. It doesn't seem like it's based on data. So we find that, you know, if we ask the very simple question, what would happen if we switched everything off? It's kind of a disruptive question because for a lot of companies, you know, they have these huge marketing departments. They have to, you know, keep active. They have to keep, you know, running campaigns. But what we try to do when we first interact with it, when we first work with the company, is to step back and actually measure how effective these campaigns really are. We find that we are much more rigorous in how we measure effectiveness than they normally are on their own.
Yeah, I love that about data science. I've personally worked at companies, and I've worked with companies, and I've seen companies where they're such massive, giant machines. They have so many people that are working there, and they have all these archaic processes that have been established, and they're like entrenched there. Some people just come to work and sit there for like 6 hours and then do work for 1 hour. And it's just like, it makes me sad that people could be spending their lives doing better things, and instead they're doing these archaic and just old school, old fashioned marketing processes or whatever other type of processes. You guys are kind of acting as a disruptor to this old fashioned way of thinking.
Yeah. And it's hard to change, right? These large companies, you can't just go in there and change one marketing campaign. You kind of have to do it all at once. And you say, look, everyone, you have to all play by the same rules. You have to all respect this universal control. You all have to follow the same measurement standards. You can't just go to like one particular campaign and say, well, we'll just try this one here, because they'll say, look, why are you measuring me with this, you know, truthful metric? Whereas everyone else, you know, can
get some slack.
Yeah. So you kind of have to go to like the head of marketing and say, look, we're going to transform the way you do your marketing completely, not just one campaign at a time.
Yeah. And a lot of people like think of it, because I've also kind of, not that I've initiated anything that of that scale as you described, but like even talking to people about things like that, they often take it in a very adverse effect because they think they're going to lose their jobs out of it, which is not always the case. Like in many situations, if somebody's been with the company for a while, the company is more likely to keep them. All they have to do is kind of upskill, you know, take some courses, learn some new skills and evolve the way they approach their work. And, you know, if you're open-minded, you should be excited about learning new things. So that's the way I think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also like we found that a lot of companies that we've worked with, you'll talk to the analysts at the ground level and they'll agree, like they'll know that it's a useless
process.
Well, like it's certainly more complicated than it needs to be, and it's and asking the question, well, what would happen if the process was, you know, much simpler or, you know, even random? Like what would actually happen? I think it's more widely accepted at an unofficial level than at an official level.
Definitely. And most of the time, like in companies like that, the top level managers, they just don't have the time to review everything. Can't keep track of everything. And so like, what would your, like, just out of curiosity, because I found myself in situations like that where like I'm a data scientist in a company and I see a process that is useless. I see people doing it day in, day out, this certain part of their role, which can be completely, you know, taken out of the equation, nothing will change. Like my gut feeling is telling me that's the case. What steps would you recommend to somebody in my position? Somebody who's not consulting from external, but from within the company can see that something is not necessary. How would you go about, first of all, you know, getting some evidence that this is not necessary? And then second, how would you go about communicating it to the stakeholders to change things?
What we found is that it's certainly hard to go in and say, look, we don't think you're generating a lot of activity and we don't think it's working efficiently. The more effective thing is to ask the question and see what the evidence says, and basically run an experiment. And it's certainly hard if there's the environment is that it's volume driven, that there needs to be, you know, a certain amount of activity per month. But it's about asking the question. There is a lot of I think literature that out there in terms of basically how effective, you know, running randomized controlled trials are in terms of establishing what's effective and what's not. I mean, I think I can probably send you a link on the trials that Facebook experiments that Facebook runs, and you would think that you know, Facebook has, you know, tons and tons of data that they would be able to predict almost anything. It turns out that even for them, like, they need to run an experiment to establish the truth. So I guess my advice would be to, where you can, find evidence and collect it and build your case from there. Because if you let the evidence speak for itself, you don't try to say, look, I'm going to argue one way or the other. You say, well, let's just ask the question, what data would we need to answer that question and collect the data? You know, if people are willing to listen, they'll listen to you. I'm sure there are always, you know, various political incentives and things going on. But I think if you have open-minded people listening to you, then the evidence is compelling, then they'll see it.
Definitely. And would love to see that link on the Facebook trials. That sounds very interesting. Sure. And definitely we'll include in the show notes as well. And speaking of literature, were you there when Guillaume Swiggers, the ex-CEO of Deloitte, sent everybody a book? What's it called? Who Moved My Cheese? Or had you already left?
I think I left by then. What was the story?
The story was like the company was undergoing some massive transformations in order to meet the KPIs set for Australia, for the Deloitte division in Australia. And because of all these changes, like a lot of departments are merging, people would have to move different roles and so on. And just to preempt all of the panic that was going to happen, Guillaume Swiggers bought every single one of our employees. So out of 6,000 people, he sent 6,000 books, like, by post. You found them in your letterbox, and they were all the same book, Who Moved My Cheese? And it's about change. It's about how to adapt to change and not resent it, but actually take advantage of when things are changing in life. So it's a great book, very short one, but it was a nice gesture like that. So maybe that's something other companies that of that size could do as well. You mentioned randomized controlled trial several times. Could you go into a bit more detail how to set up a randomized controlled trial and what it involves? Please.
Yeah, sure. So it's basically exactly the same as what happens in medical trials when they test out a new drug. We're trying to establish causal effects. So the way to establish whether this drug caused this person to be cured, or whether this marketing intervention caused this person to buy something, you have to essentially create the way to answer the question is to have two universes where, in one universe, the person gets the intervention and the other person doesn't get the intervention. Now, we can't do that. So the next best thing is we simulate that by having two very, very similar populations. And in one population, we apply the intervention. We send them an email or we send them some marketing material. In the other population, which is our control, we don't. And so even right there, that's just step one. And we're not targeting. There's no model. There's nothing. It's just random selection, but you make sure that those two populations are as similar to each other as you can.
So sorry to interrupt. So it's kind of like an A-B test.
Yeah, it's basically an A-B test. Mm-hmm. It's a simple concept, which is surprisingly hard to implement in these large organizations, which have existing marketing campaigns going on, different people getting targeted with different things. But it's important, right? It's important because it allows you to definitively as you can establish that something calls something else. Typically, you don't have that level of control. You have to look at, in economics, people use natural experiments. They look at, for example, in the US, obviously, a law was passed in certain states and not other states. Well, what effect did that have on the populations? But in the companies that we work with, we have these large populations and we can run experiments to see what works and what doesn't work. But you mentioned A/B testing, and so that happens much more in the online space. Mm-hmm. It's good to do that in the online world because you have much higher volumes, you have much quicker feedback times. Mm-hmm. Typically, in the companies that we work with, you have a longer feedback cycle, so it takes longer for results to come back in, and you don't have as high volume. There are some other challenges associated with doing it in the real world.
Okay, that's quite an interesting distinction. So basically, an A/B test would involve splitting your whole population and showing them some of them one thing, showing them some of them the other thing, like a website version. Whereas with a randomized control trial, you just keep doing what you're doing normally, but then you synthetically create two samples from your population, right? And then you test something on each one.
I think the terminology is might be from different areas, but it's basically the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So basically, next time somebody's coming up to their boss and saying they ran an A/B test, instead of saying that, they can sound a bit more sophisticated and say they ran a randomized control trial.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. The A/B testing is, A/B testing would be like you have two candidate website designs and you're trying both of them. Traditionally, in a randomized control trial, you're testing doing something versus not doing something.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of like more of a champion challenger kind of situation. Yeah, you have an existing way of doing things and you want to see if changing have a better effect. That's pretty cool. And looking at your LinkedIn, which is mind-blowing, by the way, your work at Westpac with the predictive modeling and customer analytics and visualizations, can you tell us a bit more about that, especially the type of logistic regressions, classification trees, and even neural networks that you've worked with?
So backing data is really, really interesting because you have some pretty detailed information about people's purchasing behavior and incomes. But it was mainly what we found was that in that space, some very simple models were already quite good. So a lot of the times it was just trying to predict which were the good targets for cross-selling or upselling and retention. So just getting some basic models on large populations with rich data sets. Mainly, that was the main goal there. But also, I found that was also not just that. It was also, a lot of it was educational as well, in terms of trying to explain to people who'd done traditional marketing, who have a background in mainly segmentation, explaining them the concept of how a model works and how a model can be used to target personalized leads for their marketing campaigns. I found that traditional marketing people have a lot of knowledge, but it's kind of disparate. It's not really, it's hard to quantify that knowledge. Whereas what you don't want to do is say that, okay, we're going to come in with data and we're going to replace the entire marketing team. That's not true.
Yeah.
There is knowledge. There is prior knowledge that traditional marketing has. It's just a matter of how we augment that with the data based techniques that we would use. So yeah. So a lot of it was educational in terms of explaining how models work. So like for people with data science backgrounds, it's kind of obvious how you would use modeling. But if you start talking to people who don't have that background and it's more traditional, like they won't quite grasp it. They'll see as a model as just a way to get insights so that they can do their targeting. Yep. But there's a lot of education around that and communication.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I also found that once you deliver some sort of model, especially when it affects people's workflow and whether it's a negative or a positive way, if you go back to those people and then present it to them, like even not in the complex terms that it is, but just more like layman terms, they really appreciate it. They even though they don't understand the mathematics behind it, they understand why the company is now changing its approach to doing things. And that way, not only you're fulfilling these people's curiosity and helping them better transition to the new type of work, but also you're creating data advocates among them. So even though they don't understand these things, they see that they work and they want more of them. So they then start coming to you with more questions and more ideas about data and how certain other processes can be improved. And it's a very powerful thing.
That's right. And to be honest, it's not really their job to understand it either. But as long as they're reassured, as long as their the various checks are in place and they're reassured that the model works and that it's based on sound principles, then they're happy to use it. And ultimately what matters is what gets measured in the end. So what's important is whatever goal they define, whatever their KPI is, they will measure they'll measure either, the traditional approach or the model-based approach. They'll measure both on the same metric, and whichever one works, then that's the one that they go with.
That's definitely a good way to look at it. And speaking of modeling, so this one thing I was curious about, in one company where I worked, we had models, and those models were created long before I came there, and actually by an external consulting party, and they kind of like implemented them, and the job was over, done, and they forgot about them. So they were running there in SQL every month, and they were there unsupervised for 18 months, just one of those a retention type of models. So what's the likelihood of somebody, the churn likelihood is.
Yeah.
And so when I looked at them, it was not just me. It was me and a data scientist from Pivotal, another consulting party. And we looked at them and they were completely gone. They deteriorated. So I wanted to ask you, what is your experience with model deterioration, and what's your advice on preventing model deterioration and looking after existing models?
It depends on the industry. So certainly some industries deteriorate. They change more quickly than others. Some industries are more robust to that, and it depends on the data. But certainly, obviously, there are things you can put in place in terms of continual scoring and continually monitoring the model performance. What's important, well, I guess what's the most important thing is in the problem definition stage, you define what metric you want to measure yourself against. So once that's established and you continue to score the model, obviously you would have a holdout control set as well. It's only a case of the companies who purchase these models, they need to be aware that, the models do degrade over time. I don't know if some consulting company came in and sold them on this idea and said, okay, model's done, pay us and we'll get out of here. But it's in everyone's interest to know that, models degrade over time. You have to retrain them. Data changes. I've seen companies, completely change their data warehouse, and so the models are completely obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's important that there are checks in place to make sure that the models are fulfilling their purpose. The other comment I would make is that it's hard for any single person to do this. These data pipelines, they're so long and they're so complex that no one person has a full view of everything. So, it's very easy for it, it's no one has full control over the entire pipeline. They only have control over their part of it, and so it's very easy to fall into the trap to assume that someone else is taking over the problem. To assume that someone else is, checking that the model is valid when nobody's doing that. So this is, I guess, just one of the challenges in working with large organizations that I'm sure you've experienced as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's especially in a new field such as data science, where something new is introduced into the company and then nobody knows whose responsibility that is.
Yeah.
It's very important to outline those responsibilities at the very start, especially if we've got listeners who are at a manager role. A division supervisor, it's very important to outline the new assets that are created and these data pipelines, how they're maintained going forward, so that things like model degradation don't occur.
Yeah.
And then moving on to the tools. What are the tools of your trade, Wilson? What do you use on a daily basis at your current role at Ambiata?
Yeah, so I use R and Python. I do some Bash. And that's mainly because the data sets that we work with are all, they're all basically text files. We don't actually access databases directly ourselves. Within that, in terms of, I guess I would probably use ggplot2 every day. That's a plotting package for R.
Yep.
And in terms of modeling itself, I'd use Carrot. It's a modeling package for R.
How do you spell that?
Carrot, C-A-R-E-T.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something, there's another equivalent in Python as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, here at Ambiato, there's a bunch of us that use R and a bunch that use Python. Every time I mention there's a package in R, one of my colleagues mentions there's an equivalent package in Python. But in terms of modeling itself, in terms of building the models, we've been using a lot of VowPoolWabbit for linear models.
VowPoolWabbit, how do you spell that? Wabbit.
It's VowPaL. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
WABBIT. So it's basically a very fast algorithm for building linear models. When you have like large data sets that we work with, it's handy to have something that will pretty much just work very quickly. You're not so limited by the size of your data. And the other thing that we would use typically is XGBoost.
What's that for?
That would be more for building. So VowPoolWabbit is more for linear models, whereas for XGBoost, we'd probably use that more for tree-based models that we train. But in terms of like modeling, we probably wouldn't get much more sophisticated than that. The hard part is always getting the data and getting the data in the right shape.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like you totally know your tools with Carrot, VowPoolWabbit, and XGBoost. It sounds like you've got it all covered there.
Yeah, we don't use too many. We try to make the problem fit the tools that we have. And when you have tools that are good enough, that, you know, general purpose enough, you can apply them to a large number of problems without changing too much.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And the question that I always ask when somebody mentions both R and Python, which one of the two do you prefer?
I have been using R mainly because I like to use ggplot2. I know there's apparently a Python package, there's a Python version of ggplot, but I never used it. But in terms of data manipulation, I would probably use Python more. I would use the pandas package in Python much more. I think eventually as the packages for Python start to mature, I might start doing more and more in Python. It's just in terms of data visualization, I end up using ggplot2 because I'm much more comfortable with that.
Okay, yeah, I agree. You can't beat ggplot2. And I had a look at the ggplot version for Python. It's very juvenile state. You know, it's not very tested.
Yeah.
It's not anywhere near to ggplot2 in R. Just out of curiosity, why, in your opinion, is the pandas package in Python better than the integrated data frame functionality in R?
I think there was some speed.
Uh-huh.
There was some benchmarking that was done, and I think pandas came out slightly faster.
Yeah, I kind of heard some similar research as well.
And only because I think the Python code itself is neater, like visually, it's neater as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Other than that, I'm not particularly strong. I'm not particularly an advocate for one over the other. It's just a matter of preference, I think.
Okay, fair enough. And for R, I'm assuming you use the RStudio. For Python, what IDE do you use there?
The platform that we use, we end up using we use IPython, basically. Mm-hmm. We have these IPython notebooks that we use, and I don't have so much experience with them, but the little experience I have with IPython notebooks, it looks very good.
That's awesome, because now they're actually called Jupyter notebooks, right? Because they've implemented, Julia, Python, and R. And the best part is, like, I get a lot of students come to me, I wouldn't say like a lot, but occasionally I get the question, because I have a course on Python and I used Jupyter notebooks as the development environment to code. And Jupyter notebooks, they're kind of like in browser modes, right? I don't know. Maybe you might have a different platform.
Same.
So, like, they're in browser mode, and students ask me, "Is this just for training?" And then, you know, like in real world, you use Python in a different kind of thing. Like, you know, RStudio has its own studio.
No,
like it's awesome that, you know, you've given this example that in your work and on a day to day basis, you use Jupyter or IPython notebooks, which are in browser mode, and you are able to analyze data, perform data manipulation, and drive insights.
Yeah, because we're doing the same task, right? We're trying to like we'll have a data set, we don't know anything about it. We have to understand it in an exploratory way. And so, yeah, these notebooks are good for that.
Yeah, and I find it's a very also, well, I haven't used them in a workplace environment, but I've heard that they're good for collaboration. So somebody can just save it and somebody else can open it and it's
easy
to move around like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's really cool. And so can you tell us, as a data scientist, you obviously run into lots of challenges on a daily basis and some are similar, some are different. What has been for you the biggest challenge ever as a data scientist?
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge is, it's none of the data. The data is messy and you got to clean it and all that. But the bigger challenge is always the interactions with these large organizations. It's navigating for example, trying to find out where the data is. And you find out, you know, only some people know where the data is and some people have different versions of the data. It's navigating the maze of getting your hands on the data in the first place.
Definitely.
I think that's a common thing for any consulting company. But yeah, definitely getting your hands on the data. But also, like I mentioned, these pipelines are so long, like getting the data, being sure that it's as clean or as reliable as you can get it to be, and then taking it through that whole process, you know, doing all the data manipulation on your side, building the model, and then the scoring. That whole pipeline is so long, and so there's two points where the data comes in and the data goes out, and making sure that you have it as robust as you can. To, you know, like there'll be things that come up, they'll change the definition of one of the columns or something, and they won't tell you. And so they're like, because you don't have control over the whole pipeline, it's, I guess, making things fault tolerant is very hard. You can't expect everyone to be perfect. Like, mistakes will happen, but making your project fault tolerant to that is very hard.
Yeah, it's a lot of effort. And like looking back at the Deloitte days, you know, sometimes stuff just goes down, right? Somebody sends the data set and all the columns are in French.
You get or, like an Excel sheet.
Like you say, somebody like deletes a column or adds a column halfway through the project.
Or
you get a data set in a weird format and it's so big that you can't open it, so you don't know what to do with it. It's crazy, the stuff that goes down.
So it's making sure that there are certain standards that, or interface standards that are adhered to. That's one of the most important and hardest parts of the job.
Okay, fair enough. And speaking of your work at Ambiata, what would you say is one of your most recent biggest wins that you can share with us? Something that you and maybe as part of a team or by yourself, you have achieved and that you're very proud of as a data scientist?
One of the biggest achievements that we've had is being able to ingest terabytes and terabytes of website data, web log data that's not in, you know, a clean format. It's these very, very messy JSON files with, you know, the tags are all completely jumbled and there's no system to it. We've been able to ingest that, and we are still ingesting it for a media organization, and being able to build, to turn that into useful data. That's data that basically no one else at that company was able to work with, but we've got a really, you know, really good team of engineers in our company, and so they're able to ingest that. And as data scientists, we're actually able to work with that, and as a result, show insights back to the company that they'd never seen before. Being able to work with a bunch of really talented engineers who can extract the messy web data, I think that was really a big win for us.
Yeah, that sounds like a big undertaking. And when you say web data, is it like user activity data or some other type of data?
Yeah. So basically, who went to which website, where, what articles did they read, how long did they spend there, what kind of articles do they read, stuff like that. So a lot of that's, you can combine it and work out. You can use it to basically build models to find out. Yeah. If I know this person is going to do this, then who else is going to do that? So it's a big piece of work.
Yeah. So kind of like classification on one side, and probably you'll be able to do some recommender type of system on the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's surprising because by now you'd think it would be all handled by Google Analytics or some other data point creation tool.
Yeah, so there are a lot of companies vying for this space, but it's being able to do this at scale and also being able to do it quickly. It takes a lot of work to get that right.
Fair enough. And just out of curiosity, when you as a team go into a company that you're consulting for, how big are your teams normally?
It does depend on the nature of the project, but typically, like the way the project starts out is we do some like simple work that it's simple to us, but for whatever reason is like maybe we're able to look at the data in a different way that they've never been able to. So we start out fairly small with basically one or two of us just getting some basic insights and putting them into slides. That serves two purposes. One is that it gets our clients comfortable with working with us, like, and they see that you know, we can deliver useful work to them. But on the other hand, it also, number two, is that it also gets us familiar with the data and gives us an opportunity to explore and work out what the problem is. And once we understand that, once we feel like we've got a good handle on the data, we can start pursuing more interesting problems as well.
Yeah, that's a interesting, good approach. I think it's a good idea to get the client comfortable first and then scale up. All right. And so another interesting question I have is, what's your most favorite thing about being a data scientist?
My favorite part of being a data scientist is that you can let the data speak for itself. You don't have any biases. You know, you don't have any agenda to push. You're just saying, look, let's just, like, the agenda I push is to say, all right, let the evidence speak for itself. That's actually very powerful because you can cut through a lot of opinion. You can cut through a lot of beliefs that have formed in an organization over time, and very elegantly cut through all that and say, well, this is what the evidence, what the data says.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that's kind of I also love that about data science, that it's, you know, in a way data science is like consulting, right? Consulting is like top down approach, data science is bottom up approach. But in consulting, oftentimes consultants don't, like, you know, they're hired by somebody, so they oftentimes have to say something to please that party that hired them in order to keep the job. And that is often expected of them. Whereas with data, whether you like it or not, data is just going to tell the truth. And the truth can be ugly at times, but it's just going to tell you the truth. And there's no way around it, right?
Yeah, the truth can definitely be ugly, and you know, it can burn us as well. But the point is that if you don't expose the truth, then someone else will. So you might as well get to it first.
Exactly, and it's for the best. Fantastic. So we're nearing our end of this podcast or interview. I was just wondering, from all of your experience, from your PhD, from your work at a bank, from your work in consulting, from your work in the industry, like you've seen everything about data science that like I can possibly imagine. Where do you think this field is going? Where do you think the field of data science is going to be in 5 or even 10 years from now?
It's hard to say because, like, to be honest, I've never been really comfortable with the phrase data science because it's not a well-defined term and everyone has a different definition of it and all that, and there's a lot of hype and buzzwords. So my fear has always been that, you know, after the hype, people would get disillusioned and reject it. I think what's more important is not like data science, the field itself, but data literacy. Like, I think it's more important that everyone has some basic, like, not everyone needs to be an expert in this field, but they have some basic understanding of what it means to look at the data and see a distribution and be able to come up with an intelligent question about it, not just, you know, following the same old, you know, just getting numbers out of Excel and doing the same old basic calculations that has always been done. I think having data literacy at the managerial level is important. I think that's what's going to happen. I also think that also in terms of data visualization, I think people are going to be expecting more. People don't want to sit through, you know, 20 slides of the same thing over and over again. They want to be engaged, and they want to be engaged with what they're being presented with. And I think that data visualization is highly important for that.
Fantastic. I totally agree. Data visualization is getting more and more popular. You just need to look at Tableau Public and see how many people are jumping on top of that every single day. Yeah. And also with the data literacy, you can actually feel when you come into a company, you can actually feel how people are starting to realize is that they know that they need to learn data, and they want to, because that's where the world's going. You know, it's in our daily lives. It's not just in our workplaces, and it's definitely where everyone's going. Your background is obviously a PhD, and you've had a lot of involvement in academia. If somebody doesn't have a PhD, do you think they can still get into this space?
Oh yeah, absolutely. To be honest, there are so many free online resources out there that it's just a matter of dedicating the time to learn it. So there are plenty of resources, like learning how to program, like learning basic statistics. It's not easy, but it's an investment that you just have to spend some time in it if you really feel it's important. And yeah, I think you certainly don't need a PhD for it. It's learning how to think like a scientist, that certainly helps. But I think that anyone with a curious mind can do that.
Fantastic. Love it. And that's a great segue into our closing questions. Do you have any career aspirations that you could share with our listeners, or any inspirations that could push our analysts and data scientists further to better their careers?
Like for me personally, I never really studied Bayesian statistics in university. So I feel like I need to definitely read more on that and learn more about that. Again, there's a package called RStan, which is good for Bayesian analysis, and I still need to learn how to use that properly. In terms of inspirations, I think there's a lot of I recently found out that Facebook has an insights blog. There are some cool papers that Facebook occasionally publishes. So yeah, there are some interesting things going on there as well.
Okay, definitely. We'll include that in the show notes, a link to the Facebook's Inside blog. I'll be interested to check that out as well. So if our listeners would like to learn more about Wilson Pock, where can they find you? Where can they learn more about your career?
Yeah, so probably the easiest way is to just search for me on LinkedIn, or you could go to my company's website, which is ambiata.com. That's probably the simplest way.
Awesome. And so Ambiata is a Sydney-based company?
Yes, that's right.
Awesome. So guys who are listening to this, if you ever need some consulting or data science work, or consulting in the space of data science, go to ambiata.com and write them an email and ask specifically for Dr. Wilson Pock to make sure you get the right person. And I'm sure Wilson will sort you out and give you the best possible advice. And our final question for today, your one favorite book about data science that can help our listeners become better at this profession?
The obvious one is Elements of Statistical Learning, which is like the Bible of data science. So you've probably heard that one. But I'll actually name a couple more that are not so obvious. One is The Visual Display of Quantitative Information by Edward Tufte. Mm-hmm. Like I said, data visualization is very important. I think it's not even a data science book. It's more of a graphical design book. But it has principles on how to make your data visualizations clear and impactful. And the other one that I would recommend, it's more of a marketing book, but it's called How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp, and it's basically like a proper marketing science book, in that this guy is he's a professor from Adelaide. He's written this book about applying scientific methods to marketing, and I'm going through it now, and it's very good.
Well, fantastic. Well, there you go, folks. Not just one book. Wilson recommended three books that you can look into: Elements of Statistical Learning, Visual Display of Quantitative Information, and How Brands Grow. So check those out. Sounds like some interesting reads. And Wilson, thank you. Thank you very much for coming onto the show and sharing your knowledge and wisdom with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carol.
All right. Take care. There you have it, and thank you so much for being here today. Really appreciate you. That was Dr. Wilson Pock. Hope you picked up lots of valuable information from here. I definitely learned a thing or two. And this was episode number 3 of the Super Data Science Podcast. We're ramping things up. I'm super excited that this is picking up. Lots of people are starting to follow. Lots of people are starting to listen in. So if you know anybody who might be interested, don't forget to share this episode. It's superdatascience.com/3, just the number 3. And that's exactly as well where you can get the show notes for today. So head on over there and check out the show notes for this episode. Also, while you're on the website, make sure to leave a comment in the comment section below this episode. We would love to hear from you and know what you thought of today's podcast. And I hope to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.